We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Ronnie Stoffele, researcher and fund manager at Incrementum, and also the author of the In Gold We Trust report. Thanks for joining me today, Ronnie.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
So in this year's report, it's entitled Monetary Climate Change. So how do these two things go together, and how should environmental policies include considerations towards the debt-based monetary system?
Well, it's actually a bit of a provocative title. And, I've got the cover here. So we've got the Statue of Liberty drowning in debt. So we wanted to educate people and to make the point that nowadays everybody is talking about climate change, about sustainability, and so on. Everything that you can buy is sustainable. From beer to government debt to whatever real estate. But I think it's important to also talk about the sustainability of our monetary system. And from our point of view, it is not sustainable. And I think since basically Richard Nixon temporarily decoupled the US dollar from gold, that's almost 50 years from now. We're speaking of the golden wedding. I don't know if that works in the English language as well, but if you're married for 50 years, you've got the golden wedding over here, or the golden anniversary, sorry. But it seems that now this end of this temporary decoupling is really close, because from my point of view, if we have a look at debt charts, at the charts of monetary growth and so on, it is fairly obvious that this is not sustainable. And therefore we said, okay, let's talk about those topics that are probably as important as the other climate change. So monetary climate change is real. And therefore for us, it was really, really something very dear to our hearts to talk about it, to address those issues, and to inform people.
So there's really five main pillars that you kind of go through in this year's report. So why don't we start with the first of budgetary nonchalance. What does that mean to you, Ronnie?
Well, actually, you know, we all know that last year was quite historic, and that the debt piles that were already pretty high before the COVID crisis, that they are now significantly higher. And I think it's clear that fiscal conservatism has been in retreat for quite some time. And over here in the Eurozone, we had the credo of the frugal Swabian housewife, especially after the Greek debt crisis. So everybody tried to get their books in order, but now I think this is basically over. Austerity is out. We're seeing the comeback of big government. And From my point of view, it is really important, because politicians and central bankers are really creative when it comes to finding exceptions to rules that they have decided on, or where people have voted on. You know, the Maastricht criteria, for example. Nobody cares about those rules anymore. So this pretty permissive fiscal zeitgeist has also significant implications for monetary policy, and therefore we dedicate quite a lot of room to this first topic of the budgetary nonchalance.
Mm-hmm. So the second one is the merging of monetary and fiscal policy, and kind of a quote that you have in there is, this closer liaison between monetary and fiscal policy grows, and the longer it persists, the greater the likelihood of a loss of confidence. So I want to talk a little bit about that loss of confidence and what that really means and what it can lead to, Ronnie.
Well, the leitmotif of the 2019 In Gold We Trust report was the topic of trust. And when it comes to trust, I think it's interesting that it's highly asymmetrical. So it takes many, many years, decades to build up trust. And then it can take seconds to completely lose this trust. Yeah, just imagine if you're married for 40 years with your wife, and then you come home from work a little bit earlier and you see your wife with the, I don't know, with the tennis trainer or the neighbor or whatever in bed. So this trust is lost and cannot be rebuilt quickly, if it can be rebuilt at all. And I think, you know, what we're seeing over here, this merging of monetary and fiscal policy, is a very dangerous game. And I think that the appointment of former Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary, as well as former ECB President Mario Draghi as Italian Prime Minister, I think the symbolic character of that cannot be overestimated. I think that's really a strong sign that the independence of central bankers is basically over. And there's a good reason why at the beginning those institutions, central banks, were set up as being independent. And therefore, I think if we really, and it seems that's happening, if we really seem to be moving into a world of modern monetary theory, if we're moving into a world where we don't see any political independence of central banks anymore, I think this is a very dangerous game, and it will obviously threaten confidence in the stability of the currency. So from my point of view, this is a topic, and this leads to the third point that we're making. Those are the new tasks for monetary policy. And actually, you know, nobody really gave the mandate for these pretty dramatic changes, but it's happening. And therefore, you know, we don't really judge it, but we're just observing that this is happening.
So one thing that I'd like to talk about as well, Ronnie, in that vein of this merging of monetary and fiscal policy is really this race to inflate and devalue between the US and the euro. And so talk to us a little bit about how it's really a race to the bottom between these two currencies.
Well, you know, when it comes to the topic of inflation, it's clear it's becoming more mainstream. But from a contrarian point of view, it doesn't have to mean that it's wrong. I think this was the argument by many people saying, well, now everybody is talking about inflation, so this is finally over. I don't think so. I think this is just getting started. And in the report, we dive into the topic and we describe actually why we think that now the inflationary forces are actually stronger than the deflationary forces. You can imagine it's like a bit like a pendulum that is swinging. And over the last couple of years, we saw that deflationary and disinflationary forces were still slightly stronger. And of course, you know, it's demographics, it's technological advance, it's the debt burden and so on. But now it seems that the inflationary forces are much stronger. And actually, this is something that, of course, central banks and politicians are hoping for, because they keep telling us that inflation rates have been way too low and that we have to change that. Now, what are the most important drivers for this conclusion that we make? First of all, we say, well, from our point of view, inflation is not a temporary or a transitory phenomenon, like the Federal Reserve is telling us all the time. They say, well, it's just because of the base effect and so on. From our point of view, it is structural. First of all, I think the velocity of money has stabilized. Very important point. Of course, through the course of the pandemic, nobody was really making any big plans for spending, for making big investments and so on. But now this is changing and the velocity of money is stabilizing and will start rising. Second point is Asian countries are now starting to export inflation rather than deflation. And we wrote a pretty big chapter about that because it's highly important. Third point is we are seeing a structurally weak US dollar. Of course, over the last couple of days, the US dollar was strong. I think it can go to the Dixie can go to 94, perhaps even higher. But over the medium to long term, we see a significantly weaker US dollar. Fourth point, globalization is retreating. I think that a second Cold War is currently actually starting, and the last summit between the Chinese and the US, as well as the G7 summit, are a clear confirmation for that. Then we are seeing that demographics are turning inflationary. And we shouldn't forget that we are seeing those new tasks of monetary policy that I mentioned briefly before. So actually, safeguarding price stability has always been the primary objective of an independent central bank. And in German, we've got this wonderful term Währungshüter for central bankers, which means guardian of the currency. But increasingly, we get the impression that central bankers are speaking out more often about those issues and topics like sustainability, climate change, diversity. And they're talking more about those topics than on monetary policy. And for example, over here in the Eurozone, Christine Lagarde, against all custom, she made a public statement of support for the Green Party's top candidate for the upcoming German election. This is something that was completely unimaginable a couple of years ago. So this self-designation of central bankers as monetary guardians completely seems out of date. And then, of course, we've got some other drivers for inflation, like inflation targeting, very important point. We're seeing yield curve control being implemented very soon from our point of view. We're seeing that we're moving from monetary dominance to fiscal dominance. So I think that people should focus less on what the Federal Reserve keeps telling us and focus more what the White House is actually announcing. And they're pretty busy with new stimulus programs. And then I think a bit later on, we will see rising wages. So this return of wage inflation might actually be the next stage of this inflationary game. So long story short, from our point of view, inflation isn't temporary, it isn't transitory, it is something that has moved the pendulum from structurally disinflationary environment to a structurally inflationary environment.
And as the topic of inflation is so hot right now, Ronnie, you guys have developed a proprietary inflation signal several years ago to measure these current inflation trends. So what factors go into this measurement?
Well, of course, I cannot give you the exact recipe of our secret sauce. But I think for us, it's always been important to know when to play offense and when to play defense. And in US football, I think there's the saying, offense wins games, but defense wins championships. And for us, it's always been important to avoid major drawdowns. And since we started our first inflation fund, actually the environment was brutal because we saw we didn't see a big trend in inflation. And you know, if you were long only mining stocks, for example, you would have made really, really big drawdowns over this time span. So we created this inflation signal that is basically telling us when to play offense, when to play defense. And it's important because all the inflation indicators are telling us what happened in the past. So what were the trends over the last couple of months? They're always lagging, while our inflation model is really looking through the, how do you say, the The windshield, exactly. Thanks. So what are the markets telling us? So we use a number of different market-based indicators, like the price of gold, obviously, the gold-silver ratio, commodity-related prices. And then we've got a channel breakout that is basically telling us, do we see a rising, falling, or neutral inflation? And our inflation signal, it moved to strongly rising inflation April last year. Now we still have it. It was slightly weaker over fall, and it will probably weaken a bit because of the big rotation that we saw after the FOMC meeting. But it is still showing rising inflation. And actually, I think that for many investors out there, inflation actually is a real pain trade. And everybody now thinks, okay, well, you know, we believe what the Fed keeps telling us. It is temporary. It is transitory. It is because of the base effect. Inflation will come down again. But what if not? What if not? And therefore, for our last special report on inflation, we used this this leitmotif of the story, The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And if you remember it, you know, two times the shepherd warned and that the wolves will attack the pack, and nothing happened. And then the third time, he warned again, and nobody believed him. And then actually, it happened. And I think that's a very good description of what we're seeing now. And we just put out a couple of charts showing how different the current situation is compared to 2008, 2009. We're seeing, for example, for the very first time since the 1970s, during the recession, inflation was also already rising. We're seeing that M2 and other broader monetary aggregates are rising big time, while in 2008, 2009, those credit growth rates were collapsing. So now it is really a completely different story. And I think the markets are telling us inflation is here. I mean, just have a look at commodity prices. Obviously, price of copper, lumber, whatever, they came down over the last couple of weeks. I think that's a pretty normal correction within a new bull market. And therefore, we are pretty excited about the investment opportunities out there at the moment.
And as you were mentioning, Ronnie, you know, the objective of an independent central bank is to safeguard price stability, which seems very ironic considering that these policies that they've instituted have really basically led to this inflation and this inflation in price, or let's just say consumer prices and staple prices, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's even a video on the webpage of the ECB for kids, actually, that shows the deflation monster. It's like a cartoon that should brainwash the little kids that deflation is something bad. Deflation would be something normal in a different monetary system. We're seeing deflation in many parts, especially those parts where we don't see too much government intervention. Yeah, I mean, we're seeing deflation in all things, you know, all technical appliances. Most of the technology that we use is highly deflationary. However, when you're highly indebted, then of course deflation is the worst thing that can happen. And therefore, I think it's some sort of a lie that we always hear, and that most people for some reason believe that deflation is so bad because then people would just stop consuming and expect prices to fall, and that would create a spiral. I think the real answer is, in our monetary system, we have to avoid deflation, whatever it takes. And that's something that we also described at length in our previous reports and in our books. And I think it's important, because that means as soon as the S&P goes down another 5 or 10%. As soon as volatility picks up, as soon as growth rates collapse, I think then the Federal Reserve will have to make the next U-turn. And the big question obviously is, I mean, we saw that last year all taboos were broken. Now the Fed is doing QE at $120 billion a month. And now they're just starting to think about tapering. But we know that they are trapped, and therefore, I mean, it's pretty obvious that once more deflationary pressure should be kicking in, they will act again, and they will have to act much more aggressively than over the previous crisis. So, therefore, I think it's really important to have a solid understanding of our monetary system nowadays, because it's not a cyclical crisis. It is a systemic crisis that we are in.
So, Ronnie, there's another part of another pillar that you went through here, the central bank digital currencies versus decentralized cryptocurrencies. So how are these central bank digital currencies really a wolf in sheep's clothing?
Well, obviously, I mean, we talk about cryptocurrencies for many years now, and we analyze them, and we've got two funds that combine traditional gold, or let's say normal gold, to digital gold, that combine mining stocks with silver and cryptocurrencies. So we're pretty open to those developments, and I think it's pretty interesting that governments are using the momentum that we're seeing, and this whole adoption that we're seeing in this space, to launch their own digital currencies that have got nothing to do with the idea of a decentralized currency, that is based on technology and that is based on a network. So I think it is really it's an interesting development, and I think it is pretty obvious that central bank digital currencies will be introduced also in the Eurozone, in the US, and so on. And we've seen lots of papers coming out from the Bank for International Settlements. Also from the Federal Reserve, the ECB is putting in lots of effort, but I think it's got nothing to do with the real concept of decentralized cryptocurrencies. However, those digitized fiat currencies, they can be used, of course. First of all, as they're doing it in Japan, to control, you know, every movement of money. It's just stored, and this is definitely one thing that is pretty crucial for that development. And the second thing is, of course, if everybody has got a digital wallet at the ECB, at the Federal Reserve, then you can say, well, you know, it seems that the economy is not doing so well. We'll put in some digital euros or US dollars to your wallet and go start spending. But you have to spend it within the next 3 weeks, because otherwise we will delete it from your wallet. Stuff like that can be done with CBDCs. And I think that it's also, you know, another step in the direction of more financial repression that we're seeing already. Over here in Europe, for example, they're charging you negative rates if you have got more than 50,000 euros on your bank account now. It used to be 100,000, but now it's 50,000. Now, of course, people are looking for alternatives. They're trying to get out of the system. But I think that really those CBDCs are just one logical step in the direction of more and more financial repression. We can have discussions about it, but I think it's pretty much useless because it's just happening, and I think it's happening pretty quickly.
As you're mentioning this idea of basically forcing people to spend the currency that's in their digital wallets, Ronnie, this really kind of leads down the road of, yes, you'll probably increase monetary velocity, but at the same time, that could have a negative effect because that will in turn maybe help erode that confidence in that currency, which could ultimately lead to hyperinflation, right?
Yeah, yes, of course. But in theory, you could also fine tune monetary growth much easier. However, I think that, you know, once it's interesting. I saw that in a speech by Mrs. Brainard, who is probably one of the most interesting FOMC members. She mentioned stable coins. She mentioned CBDCs, and she also mentioned how important gold is to create trust in a currency. And this is something that many people actually don't know. When the euro was introduced over here, the ECB advertised the new currency and said that, well, we've got quite a lot of gold in our vaults. More than 12,000 tons of gold are in the vaults of the Eurozone member countries. And this was done to create trust in the new currency. And I think it worked pretty well. So gold is still some sort of a trust anchor. And in one chapter of the report, we write how likely it might be that a CBDC with some sort of gold backing will be implemented. Is it going to happen? I don't know, but I think it's a very interesting thought experiment, and we have to see that once you introduce a new currency, you really have to build up this trust. And as I've said, it takes a while. And if you have something that worked really well for the last 5,000 years, then I think it makes life much easier. So. Can gold and CBDCs go together? Yeah, perhaps. Why not?
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see how that ends up playing out, Ronnie. You had mentioned yield curve control a little bit ago. So can you explain to us what the difference between this explicit idea of yield curve control and implicit yield curve control would be?
Well, for an implicit yield curve control, they would basically say, with their wording, with their guidance, they would try to suppress the yield curve. So they would say, well, you know, we've got the big bazooka in our basement, and if yields go to above 2%, we'll take the bazooka out. And this could work. This could work, and it has worked previously. You know, just remember the famous "whatever it takes" saying by Mario Draghi. But also, I mean, yield curve control is something that we have seen in the past already. We've never seen yield curve control being introduced in peace times, but we know that public debt in most countries is at its highest level in peacetime. So among the G7 countries, for example, only Canada and Germany have debt ratios of less than 100%. So if we compare it, for example, with the US, the US ended the Second World War with debt at nearly 120%. In the UK, it stood at 250%. And by the late 1970s, the debt to GDP ratio had fallen to 25% in the US and 50% in the UK. Now, I know that, you know, after the war, I think demographics were completely different. Whole countries had to be rebuilt. We saw a technological boom and so on. So we cannot compare it 100%. But I think that one of the main things in getting getting the debt levels down was by was done by financial repression via capping the yield on government bonds and capping them significantly below the rate of inflation. So I think that, you know, in March of this year, when 10-year yields went to 1.75%, I think many market participants were already getting really nervous, and we saw that the communication kind of changed, and yield curve control was mentioned more often. And from my point of view, it's only a matter of time until it gets introduced. If it's going to be implicitly or explicitly, I don't know. But I think that the big number, the 2%, might really be the level where it will be introduced. So I think it's going to happen. What does it mean? It means negative real rates forever. And let's face it, I mean, we simply cannot afford significantly higher positive real rates anymore. That's just not going to happen. Like in the 1980s, 1990s, where we saw real rates at 3%, 4%, 5% plus. So therefore, I think this is also basically the foundation of our positive view on gold. That's no big secret, but I think that people underestimate what negative real rates over a longer period, what it does to your portfolio. And therefore, in the report, we also say, well, if this correlation between gold, between bonds and equities should reverse, and there was a positive correlation between bonds and equities in 70 out of 90 years. So this negative correlation, basically bonds are hedging you as soon as stocks correct. This is not something that we saw in markets all the time. It's rather the exception to the rule. So therefore, we explain at length what a structural change in inflation does to your portfolio. And just one thing, equities that are always said being a fantastic inflation hedge. No, that's it's not confirmed by the numbers. You really have to focus on the on the structure, on the sector. Are those companies price takers or price givers? Pricing power of the company. So that's really, really important. So if inflation really becomes a structural topic, I think it's going to have huge impacts for portfolio allocations. And we crunched the numbers and calculated, well, over the longer term, what's the best inflation hedge? It's commodities, and on second place, it's gold. As easy as that.
Mm-hmm. I think it would be really interesting to see, let's say, the market's reaction to an explicit yield curve control like that. As we saw in this past week, the FOMC came out, as you mentioned, and said that you're thinking about raising rates, and we saw pretty much every market just get killed. So what are your thoughts towards short-term moves like that, Ronnie?
Well, to be honest, it was brutal, and I didn't expect that rotation. And I mean, let's recap what happened. First of all, I think it was important that the nominal Fed fund rates, the projection rose to 0.8% from 0.5% in March. So that was 29 basis points for year end 2023. And, you know, we're currently mid-June. So year end 2023 is still 2.5 years from now. That's a pretty long time. I think that nobody, and especially not the Federal Reserve, knows what will happen between now and 2023. But I know that the Fed policy will remain ultra loose. By its own projections, the Federal Reserve will remain behind the curve through 2023. But, And this is, I think, the important takeaway. The bond market and also the US dollar did respond to the fact that now we've got seven FOMC members out of 18 seeing a rate hike by the end of 2022. So it seems that Jay Powell has kind of lost control of the committee of the FOMC. And from my point of view, this leads to uncertainty, and markets hate uncertainty. So we really don't know if they really moved, if they made the U-turn and they are now on this more hawkish path. And if they are, of course, what will it take to reverse that path? But from my point of view, I think the markets somewhat overreacted. The big questions that I would like to ask Jay Powell is, first of all, how will you respond if we are seeing more downside surprises in the economic data in the coming weeks? And I think this is already starting. What is the consequence if the slowdown in the economy is broad and rapid? Then they would actually have to reverse that course again. What if U.S. equities decline by 5 or 10% and if volatility rises sharply, then they would have to reverse. What if the sell-off in commodities and cyclicals is rapid? And what if inflationary pressures are coming down significantly? And I think if we've got a good answer to those questions, I think we can project the further developments quite well. From my point of view, I think that over the next couple of weeks, I wouldn't expect too much from the price of gold. Actually, I think we've seen quite a lot of damage on the charts. It is confirmed by the price of silver, which held up pretty well for some time, but then got smacked. We're seeing pretty big reversals in the commodity space. We warned investors already in the gold report. We said that it's massively overbought, so the sector has to take a breather. And of course, the US dollar. I think that the US dollar will tend stronger over the next couple of weeks. My initial estimate, and I have to say I was wrong on that, when we played around that 89.90 level in the Dixie index, I thought, okay, this is it. We will go significantly lower. Now it rebounded again. But I think, we know the facts, and we know that actually, as I've said at the beginning, once we see market participants expecting higher rates, I think the markets will get nervous very quickly because, you know, compared to the last crisis, the problems are bigger, they are exponentially bigger, the debt levels are significantly higher. So even if we see some rate hikes, I think, you know, at 2 or 3 rate hikes, this is it basically, yeah. But now we are only talking about tapering now. So what do we expect? We expect, you know, at the September meeting, they will probably give us some more details. I think they will start tapering by the end of this year, probably. So that's our house view. I think at the Jackson Hole meeting, they will talk about it at length. But that actually doesn't make me very, very nervous. And I think on Monday, for example, we already saw some sort of a bounce back in the inflation trade. And as we're writing in the report, from our point of view, and this is really crucial, from our point of view, opposite to the views of the Federal Reserve, we are seeing a real structural move into an inflationary paradigm. And this is what we're describing in the report. So for us, if there is more panic in inflation markets, we're seeing it as a buying opportunity.
And in that vein of seeing a buying opportunity here, Ronnie, you have a really interesting chart that shows the everything bubble that we're currently in, except commodities. So is this little bit of a reversal in these commodity prices, as you're saying, a really good buying opportunity to get into some of these, let's say, lower risk trades as you see them?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think that what's the main case for commodities? First of all, we saw a brutal bear market. Nobody really invested into new projects. Nobody is invested in the commodity space at the moment. Many institutional players are simply not allowed to invest in companies from the commodity space. So ESG is really becoming a big topic. And I think that makes me extremely bullish on oil at the moment, because I think the whole ESG movement is really, really triggering a huge surge in oil prices. On the other hand, I think when it comes to this everything bubble, we are seeing, you know, real estate prices all over the globe going crazy. We're seeing equity markets still doing extremely well. We're seeing the bond markets, you know, there's still 13 trillion trading at negative yields. We just saw Greek government debt, I think it was the 5 years being issued with a negative yield. We're seeing it when it comes to the art market. We're seeing it in old timers, whatever. So from my point of view, it is a clear sign that people are losing confidence in paper and they want to get into real assets. We're seeing, I think, in the commodity space, really, really interesting developments that are also triggered by this whole new movement of more fiscal stimulus. So I think that people underestimate that while under regime of monetary dominance, basically quantitative easing and TLTRO, whatever, I think it didn't have a real direct impact on the economy and on inflation, while fiscal stimulus is working, you know, like if you drink a Red Bull, it kicks in very, very quickly, yeah, and you see that impact, and it fades off very quickly, and I mean that's also obvious. If fiscal stimulus would be so great, then why don't we just do fiscal stimulus all the time and just completely abolish our market-based economy and capitalism? But I think it's important for people to realize we should focus more on fiscal stimulus, less on monetary stimulus, and fiscal stimulus will impact commodities much, much better, stronger and faster than monetary stimulus.
So Ronnie, something you point out in the report as well is that mining stocks have had a 92% correlation to declining real interest rates. So what considerations go into the right mining stock rebalancing strategy?
Well, I think that's a fairly interesting chapter in the report where we said basically, well, what works in an environment of negative and of falling real rates? And, you know, it's obviously mining stocks are some sort of a derivative on the price of gold, for example. So I think a decoupling of gold mining stocks versus the gold price is something that I don't really see. I don't see the HUY index showing a big rally while gold is collapsing. That's just not happening. And initially, we're seeing once stocks sell off that gold mining stocks really show this equity risk, obviously. But then we're seeing that they react extremely aggressively on fiscal and monetary stimulus. So this was really shown last year when basically everything went down. Correlations were extremely high above around all asset classes. Then gold started rising pretty quickly, and then gold mining stocks recovered also very quickly. And I think, you know, from a portfolio point of view, it just makes sense to add gold mining or silver mining stocks to your portfolio. We make the case for mining stocks being a real value play nowadays. We're seeing pristine balance sheets. We're seeing strong free cash flows. We're seeing actually last year was the most profitable year in the history. This year probably will be even better. So the companies really made their homeworks. I think the market has not realized it yet, but at some point they will. And, you know, we show this kind of fun chart where we compare the market cap of Dogecoin, which doesn't have any use at all. I mean, they're sponsoring the Jamaican, bobsled team. But everybody knows that it's, you know, that it's basically really useless and that it's just a meme coin. And we compare it to the market cap of Barrick Gold and Newmont. And actually mid-May, Dogecoin had a significantly higher market cap than those two huge mining companies that produce billions of free cash flow, that have got fantastic projects, that have got gold in the ground and so on. So therefore, I think still, you know, there's a great opportunity in the mining space. I think that at some point, people will also realize that the sector is doing very, very well when it comes to the implementation of technology, but also when it comes to ESG. Therefore, we wrote another chapter about the ESG developments in the sector. And therefore, you know, we're at those price levels, we're finding lots of attractive companies to add to our portfolios.
So, Ronnie, you guys have another chapter in the book, really going through findings from different jurisdictions for holding physical gold. This year, you have Austria, U.S., and the Cayman Islands. And there's also a chapter to go along with the history of gold confiscation. So, can you give us a little summary of the history of gold confiscations and why it's a good idea to have to hold maybe some gold, physical gold, outside of your own jurisdiction?
Well, we started writing about proper gold storage and which jurisdiction to choose already 2 years ago. And we covered Singapore, we covered New Zealand, Australia, Dubai, Liechtenstein, and Switzerland, I think. And this year we had Austria, the US, and the Cayman Islands. And the reason for it was mainly because we're seeing from institutional clients, we're seeing much more demand and people asking, and those are really very successful businessmen and very experienced investors. They're asking us, you know, where should we actually store our gold? And I think it's interesting because this question didn't really come up 5 or 10 years ago. So it clearly shows us that people are kind of losing interest or losing confidence, losing trust in governments. And therefore, I think they want to diversify into new jurisdictions. Of course, there's not one perfect jurisdiction, but it's important for us to explain the main advantages and disadvantages of several jurisdictions. When it comes to gold confiscations, of course, I mean, this is something that happened over the course of history quite often. And I think, you know, there's many different methods of gold confiscations. You can simply declare the ownership of gold contraband to canceling financial contracts. You can expropriate gold by force. You can put on new taxes, whatever. And it has happened before. And, you know, in the US alone, we had four instances when private gold ownership was denied. We've got examples coming from Nazi Germany, from Australia, from Great Britain, and so on. But from my point of view, actually, you know, nowadays gold officially is no longer money. So paper money now takes that role. So consequently, our view is that the risk of gold confiscation is much, much lower. And therefore, I think, you know, it's pretty interesting to really walk through those confiscations. And of course, I think it's a fascinating chapter in the report. If you learn more about, you know, the 1933 confiscation, but also then the Bretton Woods confiscations, confiscations in Italy, in Germany, in the Czech Republic, and so on, it is really fascinating because, you know, every year we think, well, what should we write this year? We almost covered everything when it comes to gold. But then we come up with such topics and we dive into those topics and find so many interesting aspects. It's really fascinating. So perhaps the most sophisticated confiscation of gold is currently taking place in India. We're seeing this gold monetization scheme by Prime Minister Modi. Is it very successful so far? Not really. I think Indians know why they hold their gold. So from my point of view, you know, people, gold now, unfortunately, isn't legal tender. Gold was only confiscated when it was legal tender. So therefore, I think that actually the current fiat money system makes your gold even safer. And we make the case that gold actually could be revalued. So that the central bank, for example, says, well, we'll buy all gold until the price of 3,000 per ounce. And this could be a way. This is something that was mentioned in quite a lot of papers, actually, and we quote them. This could be something to further stimulate inflation, because I think that gold is a pretty reliable inflation indicator. And if the price of gold should rise significantly, this would also tell people, well, we're seeing more inflation. And as crazy as it sounds, this is actually what central banks and politicians want to see. So do I see it as my main case a cap or a floor will be introduced? I don't know. Perhaps it could happen. I cannot rule it out. But I think it's really interesting to walk through this chapter, and I think it's actually one of my favorite chapters in this report.
Excellent, Ronnie. Well, as usual, we don't even have enough time to touch all the topics covered in the report. As usual, it's just an excellent read. There's lots of stuff to really capture your attention, to make an entertaining read. And we'll absolutely put the link to the report in the show notes. Lynn Alden, also a frequent guest of the show, contributed a chapter on long-term debt cycles. It's just an excellent report as usual, Ronnie. Do you have anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
No, that's it basically. I mean, it's a pretty long read, 350 pages. I think it's really it's good. It's a thought-provoking. It's an entertaining read. There's also a compact version, but I think, you know, if you want to read something good over the summer, then go for it. It's available for free in German and in English, and just have a look at our webpage.
Yep, absolutely. Excellent, Ronnie. Well, I always look forward to getting to speak with you and to read the report every year when it comes out. Ronnie, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.